let's talk for and about the LGBT communities around the world. I'm Michael Ross, and this is Straight Friendly. We choose to discuss history on this podcast because we believe that in order to understand the present and what the future would look like, we need to discover our past. One of the biggest misconceptions on LGBT and queer history and culture that it started only a few decades ago. As we will discover in this episode with our guest, Professor Moshe Slochovsky, it started way back, more than 1,000 years ago. There are many things that are kept hidden from our history. We know only what our leaders in previous generations wanted us to know. In this episode, we will be discovering different questions about the past, even thousands and thousands of years ago. Was it just sexual attraction, or were there also love? And what about the current definitions that we know and use today? How much were they affected by ancient history? In this episode, we will be taken on a historical journey, like two archaeologists. We will dig out poems and love song remains that reveal different ancient gay cultures throughout history, throughout the world, and also the ancient Islamic world. Before we'll proceed to our next guest, I would like to note that the production of this episode came to reality thanks to the support of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation in Jerusalem. So today we have with us Professor Moshe Slochovsky from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Professor Slochovsky is a specialist in the fields of the history of Europe and the history of sexuality. Professor Slochovsky, hello.
Hello. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. I have a secret to tell that it's not only that you're a guest at the podcast, but you're also one of the people who I love to have few advices. And, I learn a lot from you. So thank you for all the help and also behind the scenes.
I think it's such an important service that I'm really happy for the opportunity to participate.
So thank you very much. And I had a very special request in the conversation we had before the recording. Usually when reading about the history of the LGBT communities, no matter from where place you're coming from, no matter in which country you're living in, usually, in most of the cases, the history starts in 1969 and the Stonewall riots that took place in New York. And my request from you was if we can go back and back and talk about the history, which was before then. And then you presented to me three categories or terms that in some way divide the history. So basically, I'm now, I took notes, and in those notes, I wrote that we have three terms here, or three periods of times, right? It's about sex, sexual orientation, and identity. The whole thing of identity is kind of a new thing, not only about the discourse of the LGBT communities around the world, but also generally in the world. So if we talk before 1969, we basically almost cannot talk about identity. It was less relevant.
Yeah, so everything I'm going to say is about the way I have come to understand it. Everything I'm going to say is controversial, but everything I'm going to say, there are big debates among scholars of gay identity and gay life and same-sex attraction, which is good. It's a lively field because people disagree, because people come up with new theories, with new ways of explaining developments and processes and categories of identities. And that's what keeps it so alive and interesting. And just as much as the term gay and lesbian at some point was widened to include other forms of identity, which has been a very good process, a fantastic process. So later on, the mere existence of the notion of identity has also been challenged. So there's an ongoing process of thinking categories, thinking how we relate to people in the past. And I've been teaching this kind of material since 92. So I've come to category. I've come to divide it into three different categories. The period, the very long historical period in which we can talk about same-sex sexuality, or people were having sex with people of their own sex. And then in Europe, and I know less about other societies, but I know enough, and I'll say a little bit about other civilizations as well, we can start talking about attractions. And it's only in the 19th century that there is a new concept, new configuration coming to being, which is about identity. So yes, as you said earlier, identity is modern, is a new concept, but the boundary between attraction and identity is not clear-cut. It deserves attention. So we can talk about any one of these periods or the first two periods. It's totally up to you. When do you want me to start? How long back do you want me to go?
I would love us to go as back as we can. And I think that one of the interesting things related to the, if we can say, the LGBT history, although you just said that I cannot use probably this term for the history, but is there any chance that because this whole idea was controversial during some periods of times or some cultures, so because of that, we have less evidences? So actually, the knowledge that we have is based only about few historical remains that we have?
And this is true, especially when we think about women, what we today call lesbians. So yeah, I'll give you a very specific example. There was an amazing female poet, Sappho, in ancient Greece. She lived on the island of Lesbos. We have the term lesbian from her, from the island she lived on. She probably wrote hundreds of thousands of lines, tens of thousands of poems.
Which in years?
Before Christ, in the 4th, 5th century, before Christ.
Meaning more than 2,000 years ago.
100 years ago. She, everything that survived from this period survived because medieval Christian monks wanted to copy it and copied it. Nothing is preserved from this old period. So Homer, mythology, Plato, Aristotle, everything that we have is only because some people at some point in some monastery, when only monks knew how to copy, decided to copy it, whether to copy it into Syriac and then into Arabic or to copy it into Latin and preserve it. Sappho, who was writing love poems mostly to women and very sexual love poems, the monks did not have any interest in preserving her. So almost everything she wrote got lost. This is an extreme example. What do we know about her poetry? We found one or two little fragments of almost complete poems, not even one complete poem, but fragments. But most of the fragments we have are of later authors quoting few lines here or few lines there of her poetry. And that's only because they were talking about other issues that we have here and there, little bits and pieces of her poetry. So a huge amount of material got lost. And it's true about the West, and it's true about China, and it's true about India, and it's true about Japan. It's a huge loss. We know what some people in positions of authority wanted to preserve. I'll give you another example. In what is today Iran, there was a very old tradition in the north of Iran. There was a very old tradition of same-sex relations among men and love poetry of men writing poems to other men. Once the Western notion of homosexuality as a different identity arrived at the turn of the 20th century, people in Iran got embarrassed, were ashamed of this tradition of poetry about same-sex love. And they themselves put a lot of effort into suppressing this very old tradition. So again, a lot of material disappeared. And the process is the same in many other cultures. So yes, as you say, we know very little, we know fragments, and we know only what other generations want us to know. So we have to put a huge amount of effort into reconstruction. That's what archaeologists do. That's what historians do.
So going back and being based on the fact,
there are no facts. What other people decided to preserve, and this is what we have available.
So in some way, we are based on a hidden history
way. There is a very important collection, you probably know it, of articles written by, or collected, edited by three leading American historians, of the first collection of gay and lesbian history, and it's called Hidden from History, because this is a history that had been mostly hidden. And that's why gay and lesbian history is such a wonderful field, because it's really like archaeology, excavating and finding little ruins, little remains, little fragments here and there that enable us to start or to try to reconstruct.
So, Professor Slachowski, if we go back with a few evidences that we have, how back and to where to which places can we go back to?
We can go back to China, we can go back to Japan, we can go back to India. But I am a historian of Europe, so I will talk about Europe, which is not because I'm Eurocentric, but because this is what I know best. Whenever possible, I talk about other cultures. The most famous ancient culture in which we have a lot of evidence about same-sex relations is Athens in ancient Greece, 6th, 5th, 4th centuries before Christ, and to some degree Rome. But most of the evidence, again, is very fragmented, and we are trying to reconstruct. What we can say about Athens, what we can say about Sparta, what we can say about other city-states in ancient Greece, was that they had a completely different construction of sexuality. They did not have the homo-hetero bi. It just did not exist. And that's something we have to keep in mind, that we have to switch into a different way of thinking about it. Sex...
What does it mean? Yeah.
Sex was... You could not separate sex... Sex from power, from political and social dominance. People's access to other bodies of other people was determined by their social and political position, and the division was between penetrator and penetrated. Only citizens of the city-state had the right to penetrate other people, and it did not matter to some degree whether they're penetrating men or women. For the society, it was much less important whom you're penetrating than your ability, your right, your power, your position of authority to penetrate. Now, what I'm saying is very general. There's much more nuance than that. But we have to think about the different composition in which some men, just like women, are the subjects of desire or objects of desire. They are being penetrated, while a small group of men have the right to have sex with everything they want to penetrate. So it's not like homo...
But they could choose.
They can also not choose. They can do everything. They can also do donkeys and geese. And there is a debate, there is a discussion about it. I'm saying donkeys and geese because there is a discussion about it, because there is a gap between what you can do and what is the chorus, what is polite to do. It's not a chorus to penetrate a donkey, but there is nothing, there is no legal sanction against it. It's not appropriate to penetrate a boy under 12, but there is no legal sanction against it. So it's a completely different construction, and that's why it's not so easy for us to understand it, to conceptualize it. But if we go into details, it's a society in which one way to think about it is that there are citizens, men, there are women, and there is a category that is in between, which is, no, I'll put it differently. There are people who are, by their very social definition, in a position of submission. And it includes women, and it includes slaves, male and female slaves. They have no rights, and the owner can do whatever he, it's always he, wants to do with them, including using them sexually. Today we're thinking about men abusing maids sexually. We have to think about a society in which abusing male slaves and male and female slaves, using them sexually indistinguishably. But there is another category, and the category is youth. Young adolescent men between the ages of 12 and 19, 20 are not citizens, are not men in position of authority, but they're going to become ones at some point. Between the ages of 12 and 19, between the beginning of a mustache and the age of having a full beard, they are objects of desire. And this is what is called pederastia, love of boys. It's not boys, it's from 12 on. Most of what we know is about, I can even say, civic obligation of citizens to pursue, to have sex with these adolescent guys. These adolescent guys, in a way, are a third sex. They're not women, they're not men, they're objects of desire for a specific period of time. During this specific period of time, they are pursued by men who are older than them, who give them gifts, who flirt with them, who cruise them, who compete with each other about who is going to get this or that adolescent guy. And this is part of the rite of passage, of training, of moving from adolescent to a full-blown citizen. You are being sexually used by other men. You are being an object of desire of other men until you become a grown-up man and a citizen yourself, and then you pursue younger men.
Is this true for the case of ancient Greece, Athens and Rome, or is it also true for other cultures?
What I find absolutely fascinating about this notion of adolescence as a third sex is that to an amazing degree this model exists in many other cultures and civilizations. Young men in the teens fulfill the same role or are the object of desire in Chinese courts, in Japan in the 16th, 17th century, in many civilized Islamic civilizations, in Persia at different periods, in the Ottoman Empire, among the Aztecs in Mexico. So we have enough evidence that this mode of desire existed, and it cannot be separated from power. And this is really important for me to emphasize the active passive polarization parallels the dominant submissive configuration of society. An older man cannot let himself be penetrated by an adolescent guy. An older man who is a man of power, who is a courtier, who is a king, who is a prince, has political, social, legal rights, and in some places obligation to prove his authority, to prove the fact that he is dominant by penetrating not just slaves, but men who are one day going to be themselves men in positions of power. Now, I'm sure it's apocryphal, but I understand. I had a meeting, two encounters in my life with two men who went through the British educational system in the 1920s and 30s, through what they call the public school, which is very elite private school. And then Oxford and Cambridge, the all-male environment, then the military, the British military. And they both said to me that being the object, it's two different men in two different contexts, being penetrated by other men, and then when they grow up, penetrating other boys at their college or at their private school, which is called public school, was taken for granted. It was just part of their experience. So here we have another empire in which the process of maturing involves a sexual component.
And I think that maybe we cannot ignore the fact that in some way, maybe it also affects the way that sometimes today, even in the current discourse within the LGBT communities or the homosexual community, the way that maybe it still affects how people preserve the whole top and bottom issue. Maybe it's rooted in our past, in those cultures.
Yeah, I think one of the most amazing things that happened in the 50s and 60s, even before Stonewall, is that among some men, and I should say a few things about women in a minute, but among some men who were attracted to men, slowly they started to develop the notion of versatility, that I don't have to always only be top, always only be bottom. And this very clear distinction that also had with social class started to disintegrate. The idea that you can flip, for example, New York in the 20s, again, we cannot talk about what we think about, I'm jumping 2,000 years, New York in the 20s. You have men who have attraction to other men.
In the 1920s. What did they say? It's already 100 years.
1920s, in yes. 2,000 years after what we're talking about, more than 2,000 years ago. We're not talking about only sex. We're talking about attraction. There are men who want to have sex with other men, and they don't want to have sex with women because all these weak people I talked about, all of them get married, all of them move on from same sex to sex with people of the other. All these men move to sex with women. I'm talking about a completely different configuration. 1920 New York, 1920 London, 1920 Paris. You have men who know that they only want to have sex with other men, but they don't want to have sex with homosexuals. They want to have sex with real men. And real men are straight men who are working class or sailors or army or the queen's guards or the stable guards of the queen. And they are extremely in demand. And they make a lot of money off it. They are fucking or being sucked by queens. And the queens would never think of having sex with another queen. They only want to have sex with real men, with straight working class men. So again, it's a completely different configuration. And then suddenly something happens in the 50s, in the 60s, when men who identify as men who desire other men start to say, oh, maybe this active, passive, top, bottom is not a sacred configuration. We can play with it. So yes, you're right. This was a very long tradition. It lasted for the longest time. It also had different configurations, right? In ancient Greece, it's about age. In early 20th century, in New York or London, it's about class. It's the elite man who actually wants to be penetrated by the working class men. So there are different configurations of it, but it was a very clear demarcation. It was a very polarization, which has been, to some degree, has been changing in the last 50 years or so.
I think that this point is really, really interesting, because sometimes we can take those things as granted, especially in current times, and it hasn't been always like that, and we can see how things are getting changed throughout history. Professor Sochovsky, before we'll go to the break, I would just like to let our listeners to know that after the break, we're going to talk about a poem which you chose, and we also had a special guest that helped us to record that poem. But before we'll go to our break, can you please explain us a bit about the poem and the story behind? Just a bit, just a few sentences. It's about, if I'm saying it correct, it's about Abu Mansur Atalibi, right? Am I said correct?
You want me to talk about it?
In one or two sentences, what we're going to talk about?
In Islam and in Arabic, we have a huge, long, beautiful tradition of gazelle poetry, of love songs written to beautiful boys. And this is a very old tradition, and we have thousands of these poems in Arabic and in Persian. And it exists all the way from Iran and Afghanistan to Spain, when Spain was Muslim. And these are, and what they sent you is one or two examples from this huge body of amazing poetry,
which was written around the 961 and yes, long time ago. If you would like to listen to our other episodes, you can find us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and so on, and also on our website, mavahasarrived.com. We're back with you, Professor Sochovsky, and once again, thank you for being with us. Before we'll dive into, and we'll talk in English about the poem, we had a special opportunity, and we hosted here a known activist from Israel. His name is Jonathan El-Khoury, who volunteered and agreed to record this poem, which was written more than 1,000 years ago in Arabic. So let's listen to the recording.
Abu Mansur al-Thalibi وشادنين صائغين هم الفؤاد به وحبه في سواد القلب قد رسخ يا ليتني كنت من فاخا على فمه كيما أقبل فاه كلما نفخ.
Sure, let's test my English. Shall I do it all at once? Moshe, I feel like we have a special moment now. My heart is passionately in love with a goldsmith phone. My love for him has taken firm root in the bottom of my heart. Oh, would that I were the bellows of at his mouth, so that I could kiss his lips every time he blows.
Fantastic, isn't it?
I must say that in Arabic it sounds much better.
Absolutely.
More than 1,000 years ago.
No, it's an amazing body of literature. I found two poems out of a collection of really thousands. And it's a tradition that lasted for about 1,000 years. Again, we talked earlier about fragments, about we have to deal with what we have left. The same poets also write love poetry to women. They did not think of, if you love men, you cannot also love women. If you write love poems to men, you cannot write love poems to women. If you have sex with men, you cannot have sex with women. This is not the way they thought about the world. They thought about the fact that you love women, you love adolescent boys, and you can have sex with both adolescent boys, with prostitutes, male and female, which is a huge part. We've not talked about it. From Greece, China, every civilization that we can think of also had a huge amount of male as well as female prostitution available for men. So for them, it was a completely different universe. The men who wrote love poems for men also wrote love poems for women. Was it only a literary genre? We don't know. It probably was not only a literary exercise, it was also a reality of the life these people lived. We have very little non-literary evidence. So again, we have to take what we have and to work with what we have. And Jews who lived under Islam, for example, in Spain, Jewish poets wrote the same kind of love poetry to men in Hebrew. Does it mean that they were also similarly engaged in sex with adolescent boys? Probably. But we only know what the documents tell us. The documents tell us that there is this huge body of literature of love poems. We have good reasons to support it, to suppose that they represent reality.
Can you tell us, please, also in which specific area that poem was written?
This is in Spain, man. But this is not in a way, there are different centers of cultural creativity under Islam. There is way, way, way in the east, what we today call Iran, and we have in Spain, and we have in between, but it, again, it's a matter of what was preserved and what was not preserved. Love, early love poetry is written all the way from Iran and Baghdad, Iraq of today, to Spain. And later on, when the Ottoman Empire becomes so powerful in Istanbul, what is called Constantinople. About Constantinople, we know much more because it's much later. It's already 16th, 17th, 18th century. We know about male brothels. We know about entire collections of poems praising beautiful boys' work in the tea bars, like cafes in Istanbul. We have drawings of these beautiful boys. We have a whole cult of admiration developing around this beautiful boy. So we have poems in Arabic, and we have poems in Persian, we have poems in Ottoman Turkish, praising the beauty of boys. Talking about these boys who are working in the tea house, we are already going to a different place. We are on the gray area between prostitution and non-mercenaries. Sex. Do the boys participate in it because they expect gifts? Sure. Do they do it for money? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But there is a huge culture of this kind of this life of admiring the beauty of adolescent boys, giving the gifts, going to specific places when you know that a beautiful boy is working, to sit there, to give him gifts, to look at him, to admire him, to write him, to go home and writing poems, love poems.
So there was love also, and not only practical.
Love means.
because the term love was being preserved different in the way we think about, right?
Yeah, you just touched a very serious matter. I think that attraction was not restricted to other men or women until about 300-400 years ago. Sexual attraction.
Like in which years?
I don't know.
In which years?
But, you know, let me do it differently. Having sex with people, I want to make a transition. I want to try to make a transition from just having sex with people because this is a social obligation, having adolescent guys as the object of desire because this is the social cultural expectation, to a developing relationship in which there is some sense of mutuality, persistence. I don't want to call it love. We have evidence already in the 17th century in Western Europe of men who are only attracted to other men and of the existence of places in which men who are only attracted to other men can go and meet other men who are only attracted to men. I don't want to call them homosexuals because all of them are also married, all of them have kids. But there is the beginning of a congregations of men who identify themselves as men who desire men. And before that, generally speaking, as a social category, I'm not talking about individual, but as a social category, it did not exist. I'm sure there were men who were only attracted to men. I'm sure there were women who were only attracted to women. But as a social legitimate category, it didn't exist. You were attracted to adolescent boys, you were attracted to women, you were attracted to slaves. It was fine. But by the 17th century...
Because the societies did not allow that.
Society did not give it space. Did not permit it. Yeah. Suddenly in the 17th century, we have places in which men who identify as desiring other men go to socialize with other men like them. And that's a new development. Oh, we have more historical records. Did it exist in China or Islam in Japan or I don't know where? Maybe. We just don't have the records. But suddenly, from the 17th century on, 500 years ago, we have records of the existence of such places in London and in Amsterdam. Men who not only want to have sex with adolescent boys, men who want to spend their time in the company of other men who are attracted to other men. And it's a completely new development. So can we start talking about love with some rare examples that we know? We have actually a number of couples of women. Two women who move in together and live in together and share the same bed and create households in 17th century England. So there is something new happening there. We have examples that we know from court records of two women living together for 20, 30 years, and one of them is the husband, one of them is the wife. And we know about it because when they get caught, they're put on trial. So we suddenly start to see a new configuration. And if I had not said more about women in the past, it's because we just know so little. But suddenly we start to know. And even what we know about women is because they're not accused of sex, because two women together, according to many legal systems, cannot really have sex with one another, because sex is defined by phallic penetration. Women don't have the phallus, so they cannot penetrate. So many societies don't know what to do with this kind of thing. What is it? What is it that women can do with each other? Is it sex? Is it not sex? The earliest case record we have from Europe is about two women. But the accusation is not that they have sex with you, rather the accusation is one of them used what today we would call a dildo to penetrate the other. So she was appropriating maleness. And this is what she's accused of. It is not about having sex with another woman. It's about cheating by reading of this court cases that one of the women decided to save her life, or they both decided to save the lives of one of them. But one of them saying, you know, I never noticed that she was not a real man. But it's my guess. I don't know if it's a real man. But one of them is accused of using an artificial phallus, because the issue is the phallus. That's why we know so little about sex between women, because most societies just disregarded it. It was not important. Anyway, we do have suddenly cases of women living together, men living together, men being attracted to other men, women being attracted to other women, and the beginning of some new social configuration.
I think we have it. we started this episode with a goal showing that the LGBT history didn't only start around 1969 in Stonewall riots in New York. And I think we just showed that, and thanks to you also, and with that poem also, when there are few evidences, and even with those few evidences that were found, I think that we have so many interesting proofs that shows that maybe the concepts were different, but it was there, it was a long time ago in many different places around the world. And in the next episode, we will also we will jump also to the American point of view, which is more known today in many cultures and in the current discourse. But we haven't even didn't talk about the history of Germany and France. It has a lot to do with their contribution to our discourse today. But this is probably something that we will keep for another recording that that we will have together,
Thank
Professor
you.
Slochowski. And I want to thank you very, very much for sharing with us all of your information and the study that that you had. And I think that we also showed, thanks to you, also some perspectives of sexual European history, which probably can surprise most of our listeners. So thank you very much.
Welcome. I was happy for the opportunity.
The production of this episode came to reality thanks to the support of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation in Jerusalem, and also thanks to Sharon Agri and Jonathan Al-Khoury. This was another episode of Straight Friendly Global. You can find more episodes and listen to our podcast on your favorite listening app, such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Echo Podcasts, Alexa Media Player, Google Podcasts, and so on. I am Michael Ross, and this was another production of A Straight Friendly Global, the podcast comes from the house of Mother Has Arrived.